So I want to thank David Simons, who is the author of Studio Stories, which turns out to be more or less a tribute to Frank for the pictures and some of the audio that he sent us to use for the meeting tonight. Remove the barrier. Okay, I think it's yours, Dr. Mike.
Oh, thanks, Rick. Sorry, I've been kind of hopping around back and forth and so forth, wearing more than one hat. Well, it's our great pleasure this evening to have Frank Lako with us. We are so fortunate that Frank chose to move out to Edmonds less than 2 years ago. And this evening, as moderator of the evening, is going to be Tom Conrad, who most of you have already met through the previous meeting that we had here with Roy Dunan. Mm-hmm. And so without any big, long introductions other than to say that Tom is very skilled at this, as you've already, most of you have already witnessed, and whose deep abiding ambition was to be really involved in literature rather than what sales, but as it turns out, he was involved in sales many years, in fact, in one capacity or another with Magnolia Hi-Fi, which, again, most of us in the Northwest are familiar with, if not all of us. But anyway, without further ado, I'd like to introduce Tom Conrad, who is going to take over at this point.
You let me know, Rick, when we need to put these microphones on. Thank you very much. I want to thank Mike and Rick for inviting me back. I was here last November for the night honoring another great engineer, Roy Dunan, and had a wonderful time and met so many interesting people who share my passion for music and for good sound. And tonight we have another very special event, and I was delighted to be back here for it. What we have tonight really is a piece of living history that is so deep and so broad and so distinguished that we are going to have an impossible task to try to cover this extraordinary career in one night. I think what we're going to have to try to do is scratch the surface and hopefully scratch it in some right places. One thing I want to mention is that I know that you guys are going to have questions, and we absolutely will make time for your questions at the end. I'd ask that you hold them until then. Our plan, and we'll see if we stick to it, this is a lot of jazz music we're going to talk about tonight, so we're going to be improvising to a certain degree. We'll see if we stick to the plan, but we plan to get through our formal, if you can call it that, interview before the break, then have a break. We've been promised carrot cake, and then reconvene for your questions. There'll be some musical interludes also during the course of the evening. So that is our plan. It's hard to know where to start with a career like that of our special guest this evening. One place that's common to start when you're talking about a recording artist or a producer or a record label or an engineer is Grammys, if there are any Grammys in the portfolio. Those usually get mentioned. There are lots of Grammys in this portfolio, going all the way back to 1962, when a Grammy was awarded to an album engineered by our guest this evening, containing a song you just might have heard of called I Left My Heart in San Francisco, an album, of course, by Tony Bennett. That song became an absolute icon. It was on the top 10 charts for 3 solid years after it was made. It was, of course, Bennett's signature song. In 2001, the RIAA/NEA compiled a list of the most historically significant vocal recordings of the 20th century. That was number 23 on the list. I'm not sure what 1 through 22 were, but 23 isn't bad when you're considering all the vocal recordings of the 20th century. That was one Grammy. There was a couple Grammys in 1963, one for an album called The First Family. If you remember that album, then you're dating yourself like I am. I remember it. One comedy album here, of course. And also in 1963, something called the Barbara Streisand album, her first album, an enormously important recording. in the History of American Pop Music in 1965, September of My Years by Frank Sinatra. I mean, the list goes on and on. But it isn't just about Grammys. It's about the list of artists with whom this engineer was associated. It's just mind-boggling. My field is jazz. I am now a freelance journalist and write for Stereophile and Jazz Times on jazz-related subjects. And it just continues to amaze me how many albums I trip over that were near and dear to me that were engineered by our guest tonight. Albums by Miles Davis, for example. Here's one that you might know, Porgy and Bess, an historic album in the history of jazz, one of the first collaborations of the great arranger Gil Evans, jazz interpretations of course, Gershwin's great operetta. Many other albums by Miles, including Bitches Brew, much further into his career, also a historic recording going in a different direction. Albums by Antonio Carlos Jobim, by Thelonious Monk, and I stumbled over a fact not long ago that the first album I ever owned in my life was this one. It was called Drum Suite, Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, recorded in 1957 in February by our guest this evening. Not only jazz, some pretty important pop, like Aretha Franklin, Leonard Cohen, Bob Dylan, Highway 61 Revisited. It's an amazing list. Johnny Mathis. Johnny Mathis made, this, of course, huge selling albums that were in their era known as the quintessential make-out albums ever made. Age demographic profile of our audience here tonight, and just given our statistical sample, I think it's likely that there is at least one person here, it's statistically probable that there's at least one person here who lost their virginity while a Johnny Mathis on. We're not going to ask for a show of hands, but even that, you know, to a degree, we owe in the spirit of full disclosure, there's some stuff in there somewhat less artistically distinguished. We got your Bobby Vinton's in there. There's a little Andre Castellanos, a little Schmaltz. You guys got to make a living, right? There's some Connie Francis, etc. But the portfolio is amazing, and of course, the historic importance of the artists is central here. But at the same time, what we're here to talk about a lot this evening is the consummate skill with which this music was recorded is what has preserved it even into our present day, and still, as I think you will hear some examples of tonight, still absolutely serves the music. So if you would please welcome one of the most important engineers in the history of the American recording industry, Frank Laco.
Hopefully you'll continue that way.
As I said last time, this is the only interview I've ever conducted in my stocking feet. There was a picture in, I think, the AES most recent issue, was it? There's a picture, anyway, of the Roy Dernan night, so maybe it was an older, where I'm, thank God I wore socks without holes, because they're prominently displayed. A standard way to start is a bio, and since we've got Frank here, there's no point in my giving it. We should ask him to give us kind of a brief resume of the the high points, a few low points, if you'd like to throw any in, of your life.
It's all part of it.
Kind of some of the basics. We'd love to know about where you're from, how you got started, and so on.
All right. I did get started. Born and raised in New York City, and proud of it, by the way. It's a great place. The state of New York is so similar to Washington, I almost feel I haven't left, except for the kindness of all you folks. I know we didn't never give that back then. But anyway, everyone's been so nice and so complimentary, and I almost don't know that they're talking about me, but I thank you. So we got here, my wife and I got here 2 years ago, and unfortunately we haven't had a chance to really get around because I've had medical problems, and I think we're finally on the road to recovery. So I'm happy to be here, and I'm thrilled that you all think enough of a stranger to come in. Thank you. So, yes, I started in New York City, had no idea. I have a title of recording engineer. I appreciate that. I never had schooling for it. But I grew up through the depressions. And my dad and mom, God bless them both, had seven children. And I was the middle one, the fourth one. So when the depression came, Dad lost his business, and he worked all the time. Went through, I was in junior high school, my junior year, and I was asked to get out of school because money was needed to continue living. So I did, and my brother older than me, the two of us, we went and did what we could to make it easier. But I must tell you truthfully that no matter, I knew it was depression, but if you were in we were in a house at that time, you would never have known it. My mom, God bless her, how she did it, none of us know, but we ate well every meal. We shared desserts. If it was an apple, it was cut four pieces. But we always had food. And with that kind of warmth and everything else, you do whatever you can to keep it going. And that's what we did. And I finally was working as a delivery boy and an apprentice butcher for a store about 10 miles away from home, to take the trolley car for a nickel back and forth. And I was working there a couple of years, and I was delivering orders and make them believe I'm an apprentice butcher. And one of the customers, both he and the wife, took a liking to me. I have to use that word. That's the way I felt. And he asked me if this was going to be my career. And I said, I certainly don't plan it to be. And I said, as a matter of fact, I thought that I wanted to go to Delahanty's. That's a school for police and firemen. So I inquired, well, I'm way up in the Bronx, and that's way downtown New York. And it starts at 7 o'clock, and I'm still working in that meat market at 7 o'clock. So I was at a loss. He said, well, I want to talk with you, so come to the house next time we order something and plan to stay a few minutes. So I did. And he said, I work for a recording company. I can't tell you too much about it because I'm the treasurer, so I don't know much about electronics. But anyway, I would like to help you if I can. If a job opens up, would you be interested? I said, of course I would. So a few weeks later, same thing. Bring this to the house and spend a couple minutes. So I did. And he said, well, I have a job offer to give you. It's your choice. I have nothing to say about it. This is what it is. here's your appointment, here's the address, and this is the person you see. Okay, so I went, and it wasn't what I thought I was going to be doing or finding out about, but I was hired to be a mimeograph operator. What we were doing then was the start of the disc jockeys. World Broadcasting would record these masters, orchestras, chamber music, just everything. And then they would put it all together with the spoken word and mail it out to every city in the United States and Canada.
So this company was World Broadcasting.
World Broadcasting, yeah. It was a, so, anyway, after about a month or two, I realized there's no future in this, so I decided with free time, lunchtime, I walk around the different floors. And the first 2 days, I didn't hear a sound of music anywhere. And the third day, I lucked into it. Off in the distance, I heard music. So I followed my ears, and I had much better ears than those days. And I get to this door, and I went to open it, and I threw my back out. It was so heavy. And I look in, and here's these wax masters going around, 16-inch platters. And I hear the music, and I thought, my God, isn't this fascinating? So I poked my head in. I said, may I come in? Yes, you can come in, but don't let that door slam, because we're out of work if you do. I said, okay. So I got in there, and they were so nice to me. They answered every question I had, and I talked to them, and they were all older men. So as I had to leave, I said, is it possible for me to come back? You come back anytime you want. Just remember that door, and you cannot stamp your feet while you're in here. I said, fine. So I did that. And after a few weeks, they were very, very nice to me. Polite, informative. I'd ask a question. They wouldn't say no or anything. They'd answer. And after a few weeks, the supervisor said, come on, I'll show you how we drop this cutter. It was a Western Electric cutter. And they were recording vertical and lateral in those days. So I did it. And the more I did it, the more it felt so good. And the fellow that was showing me how, he said, you got the right touch. I don't see any chips flying anywhere. He said, you do very well. So that continued. And after a while, I said to the supervisor, I said, you know, how can I get in here? I'd love to be working here. They're all so nice, and I'm finding it fascinating. He said, well, you have to go up and see the boss. Well, I'll cut it short. I went and saw the boss, who was unenthusiastic. And he said, nothing now, and I don't know when. We have enough, you know, the usual. But I kept going back, and after a couple of months, he called me and said, come up, and I went up. He said, I have a job for you, but as an apprentice, if you want to do it. I said, I want a job, and that's why I'm here. So I said, okay, you can start Monday. I said, fine. What are my hours? 9 to 5, okay. And, of course, nothing was mentioned about money, so I said, I thought I said that I needed to earn some money because my parents are in a bad spot. So I said, oh, okay. So I was making $15 a week running a mimeograph. Oh, he was very magnanimous. He said, I'll start you at 17. Okay, I'll start at 17. I'm not going to argue. What he didn't tell me was that they worked a lot of overtime. And when they worked overtime, they got paid overtime and also supper money. And here I am the first week every night working and going to supper, but no supper money. It's all out of my own pocket. And I went to him finally. I said, I can't afford it. I said, either going to treat me like the rest of your men. I don't expect you to treat me like an old-timer, but I want a little concern. I need money, and it's not for myself, it's for my parents. And it's costing me money. You keep assigning me at overtime, and I don't get paid overtime, and I don't get supper money. Well, all right, he said. We'll start you off. We'll give you supper money. No word about overtime. So that's how it started. And I kept getting more and more enthused. And I really was, I was happy. I've been happy from the first day I got into the recording business. And I'm still happy. I miss it so. It was such a joy for me to go to work. And I don't know about the rest of you, but unless you're happy when you go to work, work is work and nothing else. I used to work till midnight or later, get up at 7. Because remember, I lived 80 miles out of New York City, so I had to travel in. And I'd get up, my wife would have breakfast, give me a sandwich for lunch, because most oftentimes you sit there while you're working to eat. And off I went. No complaint. She understood completely that that's what I wanted, and she never raised any doubt in my mind that she was 100% with me. And that's how it all started.
So when you were at World Broadcasting, Frank, I know that you got drafted in 1943.
Oh, I did, yes.
Now, between the time that you've had your first exposure to this,
yes,
to this cutting equipment, then you started to get into much more involved and learn a lot more prior to the time that you got drafted in 43 at World Broadcasting.
Oh, yes, yes. I was totally involved, and I was being also groomed to be a mixer. You all understand that, I'm sure. That was my dream right from the start. I didn't want to be, and I don't want to negate it, I didn't want to be in a room doing the same thing 8 hours every day. I wanted the challenge, and I wanted to be involved with people and musicians of the greatest people on earth. Believe it or not, they're the warmest, the friendliest people you could ever run into. And that's where I finally talked to my supervisor. I said, this is where I really want to be. And you said I would have a chance, so I'm reminding you. I'm not putting you under any pressure, because I know there are other fellows here before I came. He said, you're going to get it. Don't worry. So he did. He started me off doing soul mic, a couple of musicians, maybe 3 or 4, and just progressively kept getting better. We had all of a 6-mic position console when I first started, so you couldn't get too complex. And
now this is pre-tape days, of course, right?
Pre-tape,
you're
yes.
Recording onto
a disc.
Direct to disc, you know.
Well, at first it was wax platters, and then it went direct to disc glass, and then it was aluminum discs. And but it was every step of the way was a great challenge. I also felt whatever success I had was because of my enthusiasm, but also because I started monaural. And if you go into a studio to record and you had one microphone or two or whatever, you had to get the sound immediately, and it had to be recorded without goofs or mistakes and whatever, because once if it did, then you had to start all over again. But it taught me what all instruments sounded individually, as well as getting them into groups. And that's such a necessary education. If any of you are interested in that kind of work, and by the time I got finished, I was recording symphony orchestras.
This is at World Broadcasting now?
Huh?
This is at World Broadcasting you were?
Oh, no. I'm going into the service.
At World Broadcasting, prior to the time you were drafted in 1943, you were up to recording in mono, small ensembles, huh?
Yes. So, yes, then I went to the Army. And the day I left, Signal Corps, Army Signal Corps personnel came to World Broadcasting and said, we're going to take over facility. They wanted a room just about this very same size. And we want an engineer also of yours. So the boss, who always was picking on me, said, well, the man you want just left yesterday. He's on his way to Camp Upton, Long Island. So he said, well, okay, give me his name, his information, if he helps you, his serial number, whatever, so I can contact him. And they did. And I was in New Jersey, a basic camp, living in a tent, and it was colder than hell. And after a couple of weeks, I had called my sister, was the only one left at home. We were six brothers and one sister, and she was mom number two. And I called, and she said, are you in trouble? I said, no, why? She said, well, the FBI has been all over the neighborhood checking up, wanting to know if they know you and what kind of a person. I said, well, I haven't the faintest idea.
That is a little ominous. The FBI's been hanging around asking about you, yeah.
What's that?
It's a little ominous.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So I said, no, I don't know. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll be coming home in 2 weeks for my weekend leave, and I'll stop in at World Broadcasting on my way before I come home, and I'll check it out with them. And that's what I did. I went there, and he said, oh, of course, God, we're happy you're going to be coming back, and all of that. And I told him I was thrilled myself. So that's how I got into the Army, into the Signal Corps, and I was assigned to the very, very secret communication group that until 5 years ago, we were still sworn to secrecy. And then
still
they finally,
classified until 5 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. So they finally, 5 years ago, said, you can tell your wife, anyone you want, what you did. And that was the first time I was able to tell my wife. So, but speaking to Bob Smith back here, he knows all about that outfit. I didn't realize it. And if you ever were able to listen in, which we had to do, those records that we made for that group, there were only three pressings made. One for the Pentagon, where we were. Second one went to wherever we were going to communicate with. The third was held as a spare. So everything was done on schedule. So when we were going to meet or talk, we never saw the people that were talking because that was in a different area in the Pentagon. But we were given a schedule, and we had to stick to that schedule because those records that I made, each of them had to start exactly on the same time. And if you were listening on earphones, you didn't know what you were listening to. There was no voice. It was all electric sounds, buzzers, just anything. Bell Labs had designed this system. And we were so successful, US, that it was never broken into. We had broken into the Germans, the Italians, Japanese, but this system was never, never broken into.
This encode, decode system.
Yes, absolutely. And it was so successful that once we had a chance to really think of what we accomplished, we realized that the war was shortened by a fair amount of time because of instant commands were carried out instead of flying into Washington and flying back to the theater of operation. So we all felt real proud of ourselves when we realized what we had accomplished during that period of time.
That's an extraordinary you know, a little sort of sidebar to the story that I thought was important to get told. So, you know, we probably should move to kind of more of the you know, the central subject matter of the evening and what happened immediately after or soon after the Second World War when Frank got out. You know, one of the reasons why the Frank Laco story is so important is because he became associated with the record label that is the most important American record label in the history of the industry, and that's Columbia. Those of you who are younger in the audience may not necessarily think of Columbia in those terms now in 2008, but in the 50s, 60s, 70s, it was a dominant label, and that's where Frank went to work. Back in the day, the record sleeves of those LPs probably rarely, if ever, identified the engineer. They rarely identified the recording studio and so on. One of the reasons why Frank's legacy has been preserved with such extraordinary faithfulness and quality is because of a reissue program called Columbia Legacy. Yeah. I don't know how many of you have seen Columbia Legacy stuff. Again, I was mentioning my field is jazz, and they just do beautiful stuff. These slipcase sets with, you know, metal containers of six CD sets. These happen to be a couple of Miles Davis compilations, all or mostly material engineered by Frank. And it's probably was in the reissues that I first encountered Frank's name, because in these reissues, they're very scrupulous about identifying dates of recording, who engineered each track, all kinds of recording information. And so it was through Columbia, of course, that Frank was associated with so many of these great artists. How did you get started at Columbia, and how did you get started there, really taking responsibility for engineering recording sessions?
Well, let's go back to when I was working at World Broadcasting, and I was in the cutting room, and CBS didn't have any studios or facilities to record. So they through the telephone lines, their studios were fed into World Broadcasting, and we picked the audio up off these phone lines, and I was assigned to record those master discs for CBS, Columbia Records. So while I'm doing that, the supervisor for Columbia would be alongside me watching me work. And so finally, when I was leaving and I told him I was, well, he said, "Now listen, Frank, hear me. Don't forget, when you get out of the service, you have a job with Columbia." So I thought, that's very nice, and I appreciate it, and I thanked him. Lo and behold, when I got out of the Army, I went back to World, thinking that's where I should go. And I'm here, and I can start whenever you want. Oh, how about Monday? I said, sure. I said, but, you know, there's an issue that we haven't talked about, salary. You remember that? We discussed it a lot. Oh, yes, yes. What were you earning when you left? I said, $40 a week plus overtime and meal money. Okay, well, that's fine. We'll start it that way. And I looked at him. I said, oh, 3.5 years have gone by. Are you joking? The guys, it's a union shop. They're doing a whole lot better than that. Well, that's it. So I said, well, thank you very much. You've been very, very good to me. I appreciate everything that I learned from your company, but I'm not going to come back. So I didn't. And I kept bouncing around. I must have taken 6 different jobs. I was the first engineer at the United Nations when they hadn't even started anything. And I'm up at the Girls College in the Bronx, sitting there doing nothing. No word of doing anything. And after 3 weeks, I handed my resignation, he couldn't understand it. But I did that 5 or 6 times. And finally I decided, well, let me go back and see what Columbia's going to offer. So I went. And he was kept his word. In fact, my greeting was, well, you finally got here. So I looked at him. I said, did you know I was out? He says, I certainly do. I can tell you every place you've been.
So this was 1946, 1947?
This was 46.
Still 46, yeah. So right
yeah.
After, okay.
Summer of 46. I started July 1st at Columbia in 46. And I went through, you guys, those days we didn't have the opportunities you all have today where you can drop a job and pick another one up the next day. Man, I stayed with them. I had job offers, but I was so in love with the acoustics in that abandoned church that I turned down a few offers that paid me more money, but I knew I could never be happy in it. Oh, I don't want to upset you, but that's just what the kind of studios that they asked me to, I know. So, but this, I'd love to be in here someday and hear it. But anyhow, so I stayed with Columbia, and I was happy. I had all these great artists, not only, well, I guess a little bit of ego too. They were requesting me to record them. So I felt real great, and I enjoyed them. And I became part of the music industry completely. I told you, I did Tony Bennett's audition. I recommended him to Mitch Miller. Mitch Miller signed him, and I did Tony's first records, and I kept recording Tony right up until 1982 when I left CBS, and 10 years later when I was freelancing, he called me from Vegas. He said, listen, I need to do an album. You're the only one I can feel comfortable with, so will you do it? I said, I'd do anything for you. Just tell me when and where. And so I did. I did the album called Perfectly Frank, which was then a hit album and brought him back into the world. People started to hear him again, and he's been going crazy ever since. So it's a nice story.
Frank mentioned that abandoned Armenian church.
Yes.
And that may make a good segue for us to take up that important subject. And maybe also make a good segue for us for the first musical interlude of the evening, which we'll play without too much introduction, and enjoy this, and then talk a little bit more about where and how it was made and so on. As I said, the documentation of Columbia Legacy Reissues is very detailed. This was a track that was recorded on March 21st, 1961 by Frank Laco between 2:30 and 5:30 p.m. at the Columbia 30th Street Studio. The band, Miles Davis, trumpet, John Coltrane, tenor saxophone, Wynton Kelly, piano, Paul Chambers, bass, Jimmy Cobb, drums. And this is a track called Tio, named, no doubt, for the producer of the session,
yes.
Tio Macero. Mike Metesky is a firm believer in avoiding fades, and I generally have got to go along with him on that. But on the other hand, I really wanted to play Tio for you guys, and yet it's kind of a long track. So what I think we'll do, Rick, is maybe fade it after the tenor saxophone solo, which is about 7 minutes. People who think modern jazz is kind of dry or academic or too far out for normal people or whatever should listen to Tio, I think. If you want just pure, infectious energy, I think this is an extraordinary track. And listen for the entrance of John Coltrane on tenor saxophone. I don't think there's any more electric moments in the history of acoustic jazz than a Coltrane entrance. But also, check this out for 1961, the work of Frank Laco in terms of just the clarity, the immediacy, the balance. I think you'll find it's Pretty cool. You ready to go, Rick, with T.O., Miles Davis Quintet?
Haven't heard this in years. Choice. Example of the studio too. You hear the echo of that? It's the studio. It's not, yeah, the room itself.
Thank you. hate to cut off Miles Davis, but we have some time constraints. The room
that was a great choice. That was a great choice, that piece of music.
I love that piece. The room that was recorded in is a very, very famous place called Columbia's 30th Street Studio. And by way of leading into to talking about that place with Frank, I wanted to offer a couple of quotes. I just discovered in reading about it that the hotel where I usually stay when I am in New York is called the Ramada Inn East Side. I discovered it a number of years ago. It's nothing too much, but it's relatively affordable by New York's insane standards. And I just discovered that it's one block exactly from where this studio used to stand. It's on 30th and Lexington. This studio was on 30th and 3rd. But I couldn't have gone and looked at it anyway. It was torn down in 1982, as we'll hear a little bit about. But it was a legendary place. There's a quote from David Simons, whose book Rick showed you. It's a really interesting book based on the excerpts I've read from it, and I want to read more. He says this, David Simons, in his book, Studio Stories, which is subtitled How the Great New York Records Were Made from Miles to Madonna, Sinatra to the Ramones. He says, I'd been a great admirer of Frank since I was a kid. I always loved the sound of those Columbia recordings. It took me years to figure out what it was about those records that sounded so great. It was the way Frank mic'd up that huge room at 30th Street Studio, and of course that incredible echo chamber sound on those vocal tracks. Frank was really one of the first to use natural room ambience and natural echo in a totally creative way. It was amazing because not only could Frank capture this big live element on tape, at the same time all the different instruments had this incredible clarity, as I think you just heard. One last quote from Mitch Miller, who was a very important producer for Columbia. Again, if you're old enough, you may remember his somewhat silly show on television and the sing-along with Mitch records and stuff. But he had another career as an A&R man in which he really was largely responsible for making Columbia the empire it was in pop music. And he said, I knew nothing about technique. I just tell Frank what I wanted to hear, and he'd invariably get it for me. So I would love to hear more, and I'm sure everyone else would, Frank, hear more about that particular studio where you did so much of your important work, and hear, you know, how'd you get it for him? How'd you get it for Mitch? I mean, we'd love to hear about really your setups, your mic placement, isolation, if any, room treatment, if any, the kind of equipment that you used. It was a special place for sure.
It was. That room was incredible. You mentioned Mitch. Mitch actually made the record business a necessary item in the American house. Before him, records were dull, you know, nothing but exciting, but he's a classical musician, number one oboist, English horn. But here he was creating pop tunes and singers and arrangers, and that's when the industry started to grow. Now, that piece of Miles was a perfect piece to play if you were listening, and I'm sure you were. You heard the studio. There was no echo put on that tape. That was the studio itself, 100 by 100 by 100. It was incredible. And Mitch, to his credit, told CBS, because they were the parents, that this is what we want. And the second thing we want, we don't want corporate to get involved. I want the studio just as is. Dirt, dust, drapes, askew, and certainly don't want anybody coming in, wash and wax the floors and so forth. So if you agree to that, then we can sign a contract. And that's the way we went. It never changed. The day I left, it was still the same, except I shouldn't say that. 2 years before that, corporate came in. Mitch had retired, got out. They came in. I had the opportunity to be named the engineer for the first recording after it was all cleaned up and everything. And I set up my normal, and I sat at the console, and I'm listening, and I'm saying to myself, it's not the same studio. It was incredibly different. So I very frankly told everybody what I thought. And that was the period of Clive Davis, and he and I never got along anyway, so that convinced me it's time to leave, and I did. But Mitch Miller was very creative and enthusiastic. I mean, all you had to do is mention you like to do something. Do it. Let me hear it. That's all I need. You know, that's what we would do. And I didn't even have to look at him to find out if he was happy, because he always was happy. And Mitch used to stand right behind me, always smoked those Cuban cigars. And my wife, we don't smoke. We never have, either one of us, and my children don't. And she'd be fast asleep when I come home late at night. She didn't wake up when I came in the door. It was the smell of cigar smoke all over my body that woke her up. So I told Mitch that one time. He said, "Geez, I'm sorry, but I'm comfortable doing it." I said, "I didn't ask you to change." So, but no, he was. And when we started that sing along with Mitch, I thought, "Oh man, where's he going with this?" But I give him credit. He stuck with it. He knew what he wanted. And the only thing he didn't know what he wanted was the sound, and that's where I came in. And we tried various mics and so forth, and separation and all that. And finally I said, "Mitch, I would like an hour free. I'd like to reset the whole thing up and then get the musicians back in and all." "Why?" I said, "Because I think what we're doing is dull, and I'd like to enhance it." "Oh, okay." I figured he's going to complain. There's 25 voices. But he didn't. So he said, "Okay, when you're ready, let me know." So that's what we did. I went out, the studio attendant. We changed everything. And I said, "Now I just need a few more minutes to get balanced, whatever." So he said, "Go ahead." So we did. And we made a take, the same piece that we had stopped on. And we played one against the other. He looks at me, I can't answer. I said, "There's nothing for me to say. You're right. That's what we want, and that's what we're going to get."
And this is a sing-along with Mitch album you're
talking Yes.
about. So you got a male chorus there.
Yeah, 25 voices.
25 voices. Yeah. And they were huge hits. I mean, they were absolutely...
They were.
Yeah, yeah. And a series of them.
And the musicians. And then what you heard when they sold NBC to television, to NBC TV, the first night it went on, I'm listening. And about a third or fourth minute in, I'm swearing, and then the phone rings. I knew who it was. "Yeah, Mitch, what's happened?" I said, "Mitch, what we didn't tell NBC is to cut their limiters, because it was all being squashed. They had no life at all."
All compressed.
So the next day, of course, he called them, and we had to go over, and we talked them into it. Explain what the reasons were and so forth. So from then on, they always pull off the limiters and let it go. So that was fun. Listen, I could sit here all, you know, when I first was asked by that fellow there, "He's going to have a few guys want to come in and want to hear you." And I thought, okay, well, why should I say no? But I wasn't feeling well, and since I'm feeling so well, I could do this another time if you want. I mean, I'm enjoying myself. I'm reliving my youth. And it's exciting.
You know, there's another quote from Simon's book that might prompt you into thinking of, you know, some of the actual methodology and stuff, I thought was an interesting quote. He says, Frank preferred to give each component of the orchestra its own microphone and track versus the classical approach of blending overhead mics above the entire orchestra. Thus, the strings, the horns, and the woodwinds each had their own track, as did the rhythm section of piano, bass, and drums. As Frank put it, even though we heard him say something at dinner about how he never uses bad language, as Frank put it, quote, no one was worried about isolation or any of that horseshit back then. But is that an accurate description of...
Absolutely. If there was one thing that I did differently, that was it. I never isolated. I refused to isolate. Music is music, and it's got to be absorbed by all instruments, not just a guitar here and a drummer there. You couldn't sell me on that, and I never did it. And now I told you what the size of that studio. I never isolated. If the only isolation I did was put a gobo in front of the bass drum, that was it. I had the guitar player right here. The bass player was right here. All the rhythm section was together. You have to hear music in order to play music. And that for me, that was my biggest accomplishment. And I fought. We talked about Tio. Tio had his way, not when I was doing that record, but after that one. He wanted everybody isolated. I mean, Miles never gave those musicians music. He just gave them a scratch sheet, and they just listened to each other, and they played it, and that's what makes music.
So you got to hear each other.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so if you're all ever going to go into it, remember that seriously. And I don't want you to think that I'm a hot shot, but that was the only difference I ever heard with the other engineers at CBS. They all did what the producers wanted, and they isolated. That's fine, but I couldn't do it. Couldn't.
But Frank, when you talk about isolation, and yet, in one sense, you were, it would seem, interested in demarcating and dealing with certain sections, I assume, into the channels that you had, in the way that is described here. Rather, I mean, you could have gone the full way and hung a single mic overhead or something like that.
Oh, yeah, sure. I had done that 2 years.
How are you getting those individual tracks on the sections of the orchestra, as he calls it?
Well, another thing I never did, I never listened to track. When I'm recording, when I was recording, I would be listening stereo, two-track stereo, and balancing the music as I expected to hear it when it was mixed down to two-track. So I was already mixing it, and so I'd never paid attention about tracks. That didn't interest me at all, and that's what I did. And you'll have to stop me if you want, because I get excited, and I probably talk too much.
No, not at all. There was another very well-known Columbia engineer named... Roy Haley, who engineered Simon and Garfunkel recordings, so sold several hundred million recordings in his time that he had engineered, he said that he was never comfortable recording in the 30th Street studio because of all that ambience, but he said Frank Laco had that room in his back pocket.
That's right. Yeah. I had recorded Simon and Garfunkel.
Another good segment. I'm sorry?
When they were called Tom and Jerry, I think, and... it was interesting, but I see that's what they were doing, and that's what Roy Halley did. They took a year to make six
tracks, yeah,
pieces of music. Yeah. I would have died in all that period of time. I absolutely refused to do it. I know he made a lot more money than I did because he talked them into a package deal. I never paid any attention to that stuff. But they were great records once they got it out there. But.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's a good segue to our second musical interlude here. It's amazing that the people Frank worked with. We heard Miles Davis. This next cut is by Thelonious Monk. You know, we're talking here about people that, these are the great artists of the 20th century, in my opinion. These are people on the level of Picasso and Joyce and people like that. And Frank worked with them intimately. This is a recording, fast forward 5.5 years to 1966, November 14th, 1966, also in the 30th Street Studio. This is a recording by the Thelonious Monk Quartet. He played for years and years with quartets with tenor saxophonist Charlie Rouse, a great tenor who was often described as his alter ego. The bass and drums rotated a lot over the years, always with very good players, but there were a number of different bassists and drummers on this particular track. The bassist is Larry Gales, and the drummer is Ben Riley, who is still alive.
Yes.
And this is a track by Monk called Green Chimneys. Again, check out the power and the clarity with which this music is recorded.
This is also no music, just in the head. You know what's interesting about these musicians didn't know what they were going to play. The engineer didn't know what they were going to play.
And look
how it came out.
Yeah, that's because you have to listen.
I neglected to mention that the Miles Davis cut is from an album called Someday My Prince Will Come, and this is from an album called Straight No Chaser. That was actually not on the original album. It's an example of one of these previously unissued takes that you get on these reissue box sets that are so great, you know, the stuff that's been sitting in the vault since 1967. This was an Armenian church at one time. Huh? What was it, about 49 that Columbia acquired this space?
Yes.
This building?
Yes. Yeah, it didn't look like a church at all.
I think we saw...
Yeah, you saw one picture of it.
Yeah.
And that's what it looked like until you stepped in, and it was great. Yeah. Now that, what we just heard, there was no music. They just played what they heard, and they responded back and forth. Also, I didn't get any cues from anyone. So you have to pay attention. You have to listen. And listen and remember. Because if they rehearse, then when they're recording it, and you don't remember what they were doing, you're going to be caught in the middle. So it's not only listening, it's also paying attention to what you're doing. Any of you go on, I don't know what the industry is today, but I was in the middle of the best period of music this country ever heard, and I was so thrilled.
When you know, people like Miles and Monk were almost as famous for their various personality issues and lifestyle issues and things as they were for their artistry. What were they like to work with in the studio?
Well, neither one of them did much talking. Monk never spoke. Didn't speak to his musicians. Didn't speak to me. I did many sessions. Not a word was spoken. Miles was somewhat, but Miles was also a forceful guy. When he looked at one of his boys that didn't follow what he wanted, they knew it. I mean, he was on top of them all the time without being vocal. And when I first started, I was told, recording with him, you're not going to like him. He's a nasty son of a bitch. And I said, oh, really? Okay. He and I became the best of friends. He appreciated that I was enjoying his music and that I really was serious. And that's the reason I appreciated him, too. So we got along famously, really. We finally split when he went electronic. I hate to use that word, but that's the way it went. I did his first album.
Bitches Brew?
Huh?
Was it Bitches Brew?
I don't think it was
In a Bitches. Silent Way? Is that the one?
Maybe. I don't recall.
The first electronic one, you mean?
Huh?
The first electronic one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I sat through 3 sessions. I was worn out. When it was all over, Miles came in and said, thank you, thank you. Did you enjoy it? I looked at him. I said, Miles, you and I are good friends. Don't ever forget it. Did I enjoy it? No. I disliked it. I said, it hurt me to sit here and listen to that. So if ever you get back to doing acoustic, please call me. I'm ready. And so we stayed good friends.
But you only recall. I think it must have been Bitches Brew.
It could have been. I don't, you know, titles never.
Yeah.
Crossed my mind too much. So, well, are we boring everyone? Should we give them a break?
Well, the next thing I wanted to talk about was to talk specifically about some of the vocal albums.
Okay.
And some of the vocal recordings. You have said, when Mitch and I worked on a new singer, we usually spend the first session just developing a sound for them, including
yes.
which microphone, as well as EQ settings
mm-hmm.
and echo. Once we got that, it went into my logbook, and Mitch always said not to change anything. Another related quote again from the ever-useful David Simons. He said, with Frank Laco, Miller crafted Columbia's instantly recognizable vocal sound, its greatest legacy. And, of course, that signature vocal sound, somewhere in his book, or maybe it's in an article in Mix Magazine, it talks about how it's, at Christmas time it's kind of hard to turn on the radio without hearing a song that Frank Laco engineered because of all the hit Christmas albums on Columbia in that era. But a large part of that signature vocal sound had to do with that use of echo. Now, you mentioned, this is interesting because I didn't know it, that Tio, for example, one of the whole reasons why that piece just grabs you from the opening notes, I think, is your sense of music in a particular
yeah.
actual space,
mm-hmm.
right? And that was done simply from the room ambience, not through the use of echo.
No.
But
no.
with the vocal recordings, you did use
yes.
echo often, and those echo chambers at 30th Street Studio became rather famous in themselves. Can you talk a little bit about what you did and how that happened?
They did. Even the English engineers and producers come in to listen and to find out what I was doing. And I wasn't doing anything that was exciting. But that room, you didn't have to do much with it. But when you did it, something, it had a belong. It's almost like you can't put something here that doesn't fit. It has to fit. And so, well, I looked around. Mitch was great for echo. He loved it. So I said to him one time, I said, you know, I think he told me once that Les Paul, I don't know if that's a name you all know, okay, did a certain kind of echo in his place. And I admired Les Paul like he was God. Oh, I said, how can we find out? He said, well, we'll go up and visit him. So we did, we went up. And Les lived in Mahwah, New Jersey. So we went up, and what he did was different, not just the echo, but the output of the chamber. He ran through another tape, recorded on another tape, and blended the two of them so that you could get... The echo just continued, whereas if you just do the studio echo and even straight adding tape echo, it stops once you've... So that's what Les Paul did. He extended it by recording the output of the echo onto another tape, or onto the same tape if you were doing live, and you just never knew that it was echo chamber. It was in and out. It all fit hand in.
It was organic, like. Huh?
Yeah, it was great. And I certainly didn't do it. Les Paul did it, but I asked him if he'd be upset. He said, not a bit. I'm not going to tell anyone. So he said, so I continued to use it. It's great. And when I left, you know, Johnny Mathis, for one, said, hey, I want to do an album with you. I said, oh, yeah, where? Well, we'll do it right at 30th Street. I said, no, we won't. I won't do that. If you want, I'll record you somewhere else, but I'm never going to give you the 30th Street sound that we developed. Wouldn't be fair to CBS or me. So I said, no. So I did one album with them, and I don't even remember where, but it was not the same, because you can't get that same sound anywhere else. So we did it, you know.
How were the echo chambers set up at 30th Street?
Well, most of the guys were using the electronic ones. I can't even remember their names anymore. The boxes.
EMT?
Yeah, thank you. And I just never enjoyed that. I couldn't get to feel comfortable with it. So I walked around and went down into the basement. You know, on 7th Avenue, we would use the stairwell, which was a great chamber, but you had to start work at 12 midnight in order to use it. And so I went down to the basement area, open doors that had not been opened forever. Here's this room. Oh, from that wall to maybe that piece there and across. And I thought, and it was alive. I thought, why can't we use this? So that's when I got help with my fellow engineers, and we took microphones, stand, speakers, and tried, moved them here, there, and everywhere, and changed the microphones. Then we got exactly what I thought we should use. I called Mitch Miller. I said, I think we have something. You want to come down anytime and pay attention and listen? Sure, sure. So he was sold, and I had to mark every marking on the floor and measure the microphone height. Oh, I tell you. And so I did it very willingly, because I heard exactly what he heard, and I was happy. So that's the way it went, and it never changed. We had the engineers from England coming and listening, and I don't know how you do it. Well, of course, I wasn't going to tell them where I was getting the chamber. I said, you just listen, that's all you have to do. So that's the way we left it.
One of those English engineers that he's referring to is a man, a very well-known engineer named Malcolm Addy.
Yes, Malcolm was one of them.
Who is well known because he recorded the Beatles.
Right.
And he said that he visited the 30th Street studio to try to learn how Frank Laco got that sound and to try to achieve that kind of echo balance for the Beatles. He said he thinks he got close but never quite got there.
Yeah. We became good friends.
I'm sorry?
You asked him about the
Thank you.
Uh-oh.
Whoever's recording might be happy.
Maybe I should pull mine off.
No.
I'm sitting on it is the reason. Maybe that's a good opportunity to hear an example of this vocal this vocal sound that was, in the opinion of Simons and I think other people, Columbia's greatest legacy. This is a track for which I will not take personal responsibility for its selection. I don't know if I've ever heard this one before. This was chosen by that famous audiophile and music devotee, Rick Chin. And it is a singer that, if there's, I think in the minds of most people who know something about Frank's career, if there's one artist of all the great ones he worked with that's most, you most associate with Frank, it's Tony Bennett.
Oh, yes.
And this is a piece that hopefully will give you all a real good sense of what we're talking about when we talk about Columbia's greatest legacy in terms of this vocal sound. This is a song called East of the Sun.
Oh, yeah.
Tony Bennett.
I wish that we could live up in the sky, where we could find a place away up high. Live among the stars, the sun, the moon, just you and I.
To it in this room, it sounds like too much echo.
Maybe this room has a
lot. Yeah.
What a beautiful voice, though. Yeah, is that a beautiful voice? It's just an amazing voice.
Oh, yeah.
He doesn't read music, I guess. I don't think he reads music.
Love will not die.
Beautiful. You know, I've had a few brief contacts with Tony Bennett myself. As Mike mentioned, I worked for many years for Magnolia Hi-Fi. Magnolia Hi-Fi in the year 2000 was purchased by Best Buy. And that Christmas, December of 2000, the management of Magnolia, the three of us, were invited to the Best Buy officers' Christmas party, because we were technically now officers of Best Buy. It was sort of like being like a Lithuanian generals at like a meeting of the Red Army or something. But technically, we were officers of the corporation, so we were invited to the officers' Christmas party, which was held at an annual event held at a very fancy country club near Minneapolis, where their corporate headquarters are, and where the entertainment that first year that I went to their Christmas party in a room of 200 people and 100 officers and their 100 spouses was Tony Bennett, and it was amazing to be in a room that small with him. I was just recently in New York and did an article for Stereophile involving my getting into several different recording studios, and one of which was Bennett Studios. I think, you know, partly out of frustration and not being able to work with Frank anymore, he built his own studio, and he has a son engineer stuff now.
Yes.
Dave Bennett is the chief engineer there. A very, very nice studio that does a lot of work with jazz. What, you know, I've read in various places some of your stories about the session at which I Left My Heart in San Francisco was recorded, and it was interesting. What do you remember about that session? Because it's a historic occasion, after all.
I remember it very clearly. Mitch was excited. In those days, he recorded four tunes in 3 hours. So Mitch came in, he said, we're gonna start with San Francisco. That's the song. That's the song. Okay. So Tony comes in, gets started. Mitch says, we'll start with San Francisco. No, I don't want to do it. Mitch looked like he got kicked where he shouldn't have been. So we did whatever the first tune was then. Became whatever number, it became number one. We did that. And Mitch said, okay, now we'll do Frisco. No, we're not going to do Frisco. Now Mitch is really chewing on his cigar. So he looked at me, he said, that son of a bitch. I said, well, maybe best wait. So we did the third tune. Now Tony says, well, that's it. Let's call it a night. That's enough. And Mitch, with that, got up. He said, he called him quite a number of names. He said, Frank, you take over. You produce San Francisco. I looked at him. I said, are you serious? He said, yes. I said, okay. So I went down and told Tony that Mitch has left, had a previous engagement. All right. So I said, listen, why don't we do Frisco? Just us. All right, if you want, let's try. So we did a take. He said, that's it. And I said, I really don't think so, Tony. You know, I'm on your side, and I wouldn't let you put this kind of a take out. Oh, all right, if you think I can do better. So we did it a second time. Again, he said, that's it. I said, I think you have one more in you. We did it, and that was it. Right straight through, nothing was done to it again. And he didn't like the song, right? You heard that, didn't you? Now it's his favorite song. See? So who knows when there's a hit in the wings. So, but
no, it was his idea.
Yeah.
let's hear that. Can we hear that, Rick?
Oh, are you going to play it? Oh, yeah.
The loveliness of Paris seem somehow sadly gay. The glory that was Rome is of another day. I've been terribly alone and forgotten in Manhattan. I'm going home.
This is about 2 a.m. New York time. We started at 11.
I left my heart in San Francisco.
And these guys are there. They're there. This isn't played. This isn't dubbed in later. They're
no,
there.
It's all live.
Everything. It calls to me to be where little cable comes.
And in those days, they worked on diction. Today, you can't understand a word.
But now you've got every word.
I don't care, my love waits there in San Francisco. Above the blue
recorded that song again until, 2 years ago or so. He made an album of duets. Bennett did a big hit in his 80th year, duets with Bono and Katie Lang and stuff, and he recorded a duet with Bill Charlotte, the piano player, and re-recorded San Francisco. I would assisted on an interview for Jazz Times that Bill Charlotte did with Tony Bennett. Charlotte was sort of a technophobe, and Jazz Times was afraid that he'd blow the recording, also that he'd freeze up in the interview, so they wanted somebody else there. So I essentially just sat there and recorded it. But he said in an interview that he thinks he's now sang that song 10,000 times. Mm. He sang it, of course, at the Best Buy Christmas party, and it was probably one of the few audiences that he ever performed for that was so unhip, these lovely Best Buy multi-millionaire executives, that he broke into the verse, and there was no applause. You could tell he was kind of, because when he starts San Francisco, the audience is supposed to applaud. You know, the Best Buy guys just sort of sat there.
Just looking at him.
He sang the song anyway. One question that I was curious about, and when I was going through discographies and stuff, I was puzzled by like Miles Davis. They would have one album would be engineered by you, next album by Fred Plaut, next album by maybe Harold Chapman, next album by you again. How did they decide who was to do what session? It's almost like whoever was working that night or something? I mean,
well, basically, as far as engineers were concerned, the producers usually made their choice if you were available. And if not, then the next one would do it. That's what happens. Oftentimes, I was doing other sessions, so I couldn't do the next Miles or whatever. And that was the reason.
I see.
Yeah.
I read you said that the day that they tore that studio down, the 30th Street studio down in 1982, was the saddest day of your life.
Yes.
Is that, tell us a little bit about that. Is that when you left Columbia?
Shortly after that. Oh, I had left Columbia. That's right. Because I knew that Sony was coming in, and then I thought, I don't want to start all over again with a whole new concept. I was ready to get out because I knew the studio was going. And so I left. And then it was sold a couple months after I left CBS. And then when I heard of this, I had called Mitch to let him know about it. He knew that it was on the market. So I said, why don't we, can't you get a group together and we go in and run it ourselves? No, I said, don't want to do that now. Mm. So we didn't do it. Mm. But
thought about it, but didn't do it.
Yeah, he had thought about it too. Yeah. So it was a pity because it was a real landmark for the music industry. You know, it should have been contained instead of allowed to get sold for peanuts.
What are maybe a couple of, with all the extraordinary people that you work with, what are maybe, is there maybe a couple of memories that stand out in your mind when you think back on those days, something we haven't touched on yet or an artist that we haven't touched on that occurs to you, or is it?
Well, there are quite a number of them. I don't want to sound conceited, but I mean, I started Barbara Streisand. And when she came into the studio and I looked, I thought, what the hell is this? What can you do with that? But I got her into the studio and I set her up and I told her what to do and stay there. Don't move around. Okay. And she opened up her mouth and I got goosebumps. I was completely taken in. And so we did the three sessions, and when it was over, now mind you, her manager and she didn't have a word to say except how nice everything was, right? So when it was all over, they said, well, what do you think? I said, I think it's a hit record. Well, how many? I said, I have no idea about counting records. That's not my function. I think it's a hit record and no reason why it couldn't be a big one. Well, two of them said, if it is, you have yourself a new car. So I looked at them and grinned and I said, I wish you hadn't said that. Because I have four or five out there waiting for me and I haven't arrived yet. So, they caught on real quick. I never did get the car. Never. She became a big star and a big pain, you know where. Terrible person, but a great singer. Those are the stories you don't usually hear, so. But don't take it out too far now. At least don't quote me if you want to tell it. Because she promised to sue me once because I was quoted in a book that was written about her. And it was the truth. We did an album of her hit songs in different languages. And she said, it went so easy, it was so... And I said, it went easy, hell. It took well over a year before we finally got the last bit. We would put it together piece by piece because she couldn't... her whatever language it was at the time. And that's the way it went. If you saw that tape going through the heads, all you saw was white. So she called me home at home on a Saturday and really chewed me out. And I said, listen, Barbara, don't go crazy. I'm not telling anything that wasn't true. All you and your lawyer have to do, go to CBS, ask to see the workbooks that we fill in. And it's all there. Oh, yeah, well, you shouldn't have. Well, now that's something else. I agree I shouldn't have, but I did. So it stayed in the book. She didn't sue me. She never said a nice word either. So.
Well, I think it is time for a break. And, when we reconvene, we will open the floor up to you guys. Okay? Thank you.
All right. Okay, call my manager, make sure it's all right.
We promised you direct access. It's 10:25, and we may see how long we go here on a school night. But let's open it up to the floor for questions. Yes, sir.
I have a two-part one. One is I spoke to Frank earlier about the wonderful technique on the bass, because it was has such a presence, and so he filled me in, and he shared how he differed from his contemporaries in the way he mic'd the bass, and so maybe the rest of the people like to hear that. And the second one is Old Blue Eyes. I'd like to know more about recording with him.
You'd like to know more about recording with Old Blue Eyes. We never talked about Old Blue Eyes.
Frank Sinatra.
Recording what?
With Old Blue Eyes, Frank Sinatra.
Oh, okay.
And one of the things I understand about Frank is that he was extremely loyal, but very easily offended. So it might be interesting to know a little bit about him in recording.
So the first question was your methods of recording bass, because the bass was, its definition, depth, clarity, presence was striking.
Well, no question, in those days, singers and most people in theater, diction is very important. I don't want to mention about today's diction on records and tape and whatever, because I have not understood any of it. So, but it's so important. I don't know why they keep throwing the language out the window, but that's what made them. Sinatra's the same way. Every word you understand. So, but that was that time. Now it's this time. As far as working with Frank Sinatra, I was thrilled. I always enjoyed him. I always loved to listen to his records. And I was fascinated of him as a person. I mean, what he went through in his lifetime, not too many other people can make that statement. But when he finally got to me, he was right, just a nice, nice man, very quiet, relaxed, anxious to please. And so we had a good connection, the two of us, he being Italian and I'm Italian. So I guess it just came all together. We had a good time working with each other. I did 6 albums with him. And that New York, New York, I enjoyed it. But, you know, if you saw, bought the record, it's West Coast engineer. Frank used to do that. When he recorded in New York or wherever, he agreed, oh, everything's fine, but then he'd go back out and play with it, and if he decided he wanted to change it, he changed it. So he did. He gave it to, I don't remember his name, but I had a great time doing it. He was a gentleman all the way.
What about the first part, the first question about recording the bass? Because it was striking, like on the T.O. track, the ways that you recorded the acoustic bass and how that differed from what was common practice in your time.
Well, I was just telling that gentleman there, I used a microphone. The bass opening is there, and I put a microphone out about this far.
Yeah, and under the bridge.
They would pick away at it, and I was always a lover of bass, and so I worked hard to. Every bass sound is different, and I knew all the guys, very, very close friends I made of them, and so I, while they're talking and running down a tune, I'd be listening to the bass, and if I had to, I would equalize. I didn't have to tell them, but when we had the playback, I'd go out and stand alongside and listen with the rest of them. And invariably, I never had a bass player tell me the sound was bad. And I was telling him that in those days, a lot of the engineers used small, thin, cheap microphones, taped it right to the
bridge.
Yeah, and you get what you get. Yeah. So I never did that. I always mic'd it. I wasn't concerned about leaking into any other mic. That's what the music is for. They all had to be heard in their own environment, and that was my interest in doing it that way.
Interesting.
And I didn't always use the same microphone either, because every bass sounds different. So I make my choice when I listen.
I see. Yes?
Frank, how did you mic the violins?
Well, it just depends how many.
What would be, for a full section sound,
yeah,
did they have like a minimum of maybe seven or...
Well, usually it'd be six first, six seconds, and the rest. It usually be around 14, 16. Then you have the bass cellos. In those days, we didn't have a lot of microphones, so I started first row on the floor, the second row on the riser, third row behind them, then another riser. And as I was telling Tom here, I put the microphone, it would be roughly between 15 and 20 feet, I guess. Just the one microphone. Get the whole section. And you have to listen. And so when I... As I said before, I listen. So as I'm listening, and I decided, well, mic is too high or too low or over too far, I go out and make a change. Go back in and listen some more until I finally became comfortable and I let it go. So, and I used Neumann 49 on the strings. Most engineers were using a 67. Which I didn't care for strings at all. Everything sizzled. So I stayed with it until I had to do some other kind of music, and then I would change. We did, way back early, Bob asked me about it. I had mentioned in his recording of me in the car that when we only had eight positions and we have full string section and everything else, and then they threw in a chorus, vocal chorus. I didn't have any more microphones. So another high rise in back, put them behind the strings, raised the mic maybe another foot, and recorded them on the same string mic. But you had to get the balance then. Couldn't overshoot them, so that's the way I did it.
Wow.
I know it's kind of a follow-up, but on the Percy Faye, you know, that sound,
yeah.
That
was a lot of echo, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
But he was easy to work with. His charts were so, you know, no problem with them. It was great.
You know, Frank made me think of something, I'll give you just a second, that I mentioned I did an article for Stereofy recently where I was in a number of studios in New York, one of which was Systems 2 in Brooklyn, a great studio where an engineer named Joe Marciano works exclusively with jazz and gets great results. And he said what you just said, that when I asked him how he gets his great results, he said he's got to go out in the room first and listen.
Right.
It's so obvious. And he says you'd be amazed how other engineers will come into his studio because other engineers will work there. And they never go out in the room. They're behind the board the whole time.
I know.
They're not out in the room and then go back and try to get the sound they just heard. It's so obvious that people miss it.
I thought I indicated that when I said, you must listen. You can't just get in, put up a microphone and turn it on. And It's the wrong way to do it. You have to listen. And it's best if you go out, even if they're rehearsing. I've been in that studio when it was empty hundreds of times, so I knew where I was when I was in there. But I would go out, I'd hear it on mic, and then I'd go out and listen in the room. Yeah, yeah. You get another picture.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, Robert.
Frank, a trivia question here. Do you happen to remember the speaker and the microphone used in the echo chamber?
Oh, yeah, right. Oh, yeah. Of course, sure. Well, I think at that first time, I wound up with a 67. Neumann 67, Telefunken, whatever you call them nowadays. And I never liked the microphone, and it, I said to myself, why'd you put it in there? So I didn't like it. And the next time I had time, free time, so I could go down and put a different microphone and listen to it. And I think I wound up with... you know, I can't remember. I really can't remember. The speaker was an Altec speaker. Not that size, but close to it. And the main thing was to control the amount going into the chamber so that you don't distort or cause other problems. And then, of course, you took the output as much as you wanted on any mic position or overall, however you're going to use it. And you listen, and you had to be... I had to be pleased with what I'm hearing before I would say, yes, that's it. And that's how I... Nothing... sharp or technical or anything, it was just my ears that determined what I wanted to do. At one point I had excellent hearing, but it's gone like everything else. So, anything else?
Yeah. How did you get the excellent piano sound on Tony Bennett, San Francisco? Is that a mix of technique?
You appreciate that.
That was really nice sound.
Yeah. Well, first off, you need a piano that responds nicely. And we had that. It was a masterwork, classical piano, big one. And then, of course, after that, it's up to you. I've had engineers and pianists that like to put the microphones right close to the strings. And well, that was never my... Just like I don't like isolation, I always... the microphones out here, top up, and put them where I thought would be best, and that's how I did it. Even with orchestra, didn't matter. So, I did Ferranti and Teicher. You heard that name, anybody? They sold a lot of piano records. And when they first came and said, we've heard your records and we like them. Do ours? So I'll do what I can. I don't know if I can please you. They said, well, okay. So I said, why don't you tell me how the records you sold, who mic'd them? I don't have to know who, but where were the mics? So they told me right smack on the keys. So I said, oh, okay. All right, let's record it that way. And we recorded it. And now I said, my turn. Sure, you want to do differently. I said, I want you to hear what I think you should do. And that's what I did. I pulled the mics out, and they're looking at me like this, and I said, just relax. So they played the same tune, and I played one against the other, and even they admitted that the way I was micing them is much better than what they had been listening to all those years. So...
I'd forgotten those names.
Yeah, remember?
Right. They were a piano duo. Right?
Yeah, it was like they were hitting the keys with a hammer. It sounded, and lots of compression also on their original records. So anyway, that was that one.
Interesting.
Give me a hard one.
Frank, here's a hard one.
Okay.
Who was the pianist who was on the Tony Bennett San Francisco? And the reason I'm asking is, well, one, curiosity about actually who it was, but also it sounded similar to the pianist on Johnny Mathis, some of the Johnny Mathis stuff.
It could easily have been.
And
but Tony was, man, I had his name on my tongue while you were talking.
Ralph Sharon.
Ralph Sharon. Yeah. Did you say that? Yeah. Ralph Sharon, a great pianist, and nice, also a nice person. So, but there were some great pianists in New York that were just part of the recording group of musicians. There were some great, great, real great pianists, musicians, everything. We had the best of everything at that time. There's one other that's exceptional. Now, if I could just remember his name. Well, give me a minute. It'll come. He was also a trained classical pianist. And every session that I had in the morning, there were two musicians that would follow me in the door, an hour or an hour and a half ahead of everyone else. Oh, Dick Hyman. Anyone know Dick Hyman?
Yeah.
Okay. And the other was Bucky Pizzarelli, the guitarist.
Oh, yeah.
And they, Dick would sit at the piano, have his breakfast, read New York Times, and just run along, keep. And Bucky was the same way. He'd sit there, playing. And you hear it in their playing. I mean, it's not something they just picked up.
Yeah.
They trained themselves for it. And it's so important. You can't fool. I don't think you can. People understand. And so, and also, financially, those guys always were wanted on sessions. You know, the contractors would book the sessions. The company never did that. And the contractors are smart. They know who wants certain musicians, and every time that musician would be there. So it was a fun time, it really was. And they were great people.
Did anybody have a real curveball for Frank?
Yeah.
What's the biggest mistake you've ever made?
What?
What's the biggest mistake you ever made, musically or sexually?
Part of your career or part of a session?
My biggest mistake?
Yeah.
In my career?
Or as part of a session?
Well, maybe the mistake was staying with Columbia all those years. I could use the money now that I let get by me way back then. No, but I didn't have any. I was so happy. It sounds strange, but I was. All my best friends, they'd go to work grudgingly. They didn't want to go to work. And I'd be getting home 2 or 3 in the morning and leaving again at 8 with a smile on my face. It was just, for me, it was life itself. So I wish more people had that reaction.
Yes.
I have a question. In those years when the Beatles came in and Elvis Presley, how does it react? Their approach to your side of music. How that did you feel?
Well,
that? What did you see?
When you say how do they react? Who are you talking about?
Like Beatles and Elvis Presley.
And rock and roll,
oh,
basically,
and roll.
Huh?
Oh yeah.
What was the impact that had on your world?
Oh,
all of a sudden.
For me, it was almost murder. I mean, I couldn't understand why everybody was so happy to hear it, but I tried, you know, in the record business you get people that either they don't have ability to create a sound of their own, and they hear that and they say, I want to sound like that. Well, you can't just do it. It's impossible. I'm in a studio and it's got acoustics. They record in some little garage or basement or whatever, and you can't duplicate that. I don't care who you are. So, yeah, that was, for me, it was the start of the downgrade of good music. I hate to say it that way. That's the way I felt. So, and it's still here. That music is still here. Earlier I said diction impossible. Can't understand a word they say. Can you understand them? I'm
with the lyric sheet it helps.
Yeah, right, absolutely. But I'm from a different world, and I enjoyed mine.
Another question. During your working days, just the daily operation, have you had a chance to go to the concert and see somebody performance?
Oh, I always...
Orchestra, like classical music.
Did I ever go to hear them live in performance? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
All the time. That's the only way to listen to music. I mean, recordings are great, but... You want excitement, you go.
With your family or just by yourself?
My wife is always interested in music. She listens. My kids, my son and daughter both play piano. And my daughter got into college, and she came home one day and said, "Dad, can you get me a nice acoustic guitar? I want to learn to play guitar." Mm-hmm. So I said, "All right." So I get into New York, I asked three or four of my friends in the guitar section, and they said, "Sure, we'll get it." And they came in and gave it to me one day. They went into Manny's music store in Midtown, a beautiful sounding instrument. She played so good. I made the mistake at one time when she was home, you know, Annette, you're playing so beautifully with so much feeling, and I think you should start taking lessons. 3 months later, she calls some school. "You know, Dad, I don't think I want to play guitar anymore." She never played it again. So, strange. My son, who played beautiful piano with feeling, same thing. He gets into college, never played another note. So, I don't know what they do to them in college.
I tell you, but it take too long.
So,
and it's
called,
have you had any system, stereo system, like to play back the records at home?
I had all kinds of records at home. My children were just getting up there when rock and roll came. I took all the rock and roll I could get my hands on, all the other things, jazz, whatever. You play what you want, listen. That's the main thing. Listen and make your own decision what you like. And that's what happened. I never forced them to listen to anything. So my wife was an avid listener of music. She just loves music. And so she enjoyed everything. She listened to rock. I never do, but she does. All right. Anything? Uh-oh. The brains are here.
On all of Columbia's output during your era, they had something on the labels that said, I think, stereo 360-degree sound.
Oh, yes.
What was that?
That was supposed to be surround sound. That fellow that you had here, I don't remember his name.
David Mouse Huber.
Who?
Oh, yeah.
Huber.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel any different listening to him than I did when we first started surround sound in New York. The problem there was there was no thought given to surround sound. They just booked musicians and whatever, and we still had to do four tunes. How could you develop surround sound without getting involved with the placement of musicians, and the music had to be scored so that you can feel and hear a change from one thing to another. So they never really were serious about doing it. Lasted maybe 6 months, and then we never did another one. So, but it's, I don't quite understand that. He was very enthused, and I appreciated him when he talked about it. But then he went into detail how long it took him to complete a record. And here we were trying to do it in three-hour sessions. And what do you learn in that period of time? No, not good.
Right. Yes.
Did you ever, since we're talking about surround, did you ever actually work on any quad recordings?
Yeah, sure. Oh, sure. Again, that was the same thing.
Oh,
yeah. I don't want you to misunderstand. Columbia, they were always following. They were not a leader in some instances. And quad was another. The producers in the classical department, they wanted us to make quad. But you don't just make quad at the console. It's got to be done in the studio. And there again, it was so disappointing. But once you're just an employee, you just keep quiet. That's what we did.
Did you ever do any electronic music? I thought I read somewhere you did some, I don't know if it was Babbitt or any of those guys.
I recorded all that stuff.
You didn't set up an orchestra, did you?
No. Well, I'm trying to figure out what you're getting to. When we had sessions,
yeah.
And here come 2, 3, 4 guitarists on that session with everything else, you have to find out what each one was doing in order to put it in context on tape. And so that's the only way you find out, and that's what I would do. I'd go out, ask each one of them, what parts are you playing? Who's the lead? You know, if you don't know that, then you can't mix it properly. So
but they would be acoustic musicians. I mean, they'd be playing instruments, anyone, on those.
Yeah, well, those acoustic guys had to get into electric guitars, too, if they wanted to get enough sessions to survive. So they were learning just as I was.
Well, what I was getting at were, well, you know, like oscillators or synthesizers or any of that stuff.
Yeah. Well, that was usually done after the synthesizers, after, and then it can devote time, sit there in the control room with me or other engineers, and we'd be hearing it as they are playing and also playing against or with. And that's the only way I did it. I don't know what else.
It just seems so, you know, like a foreign language compared to, you know, having a beautiful studio, having people in there playing, and, you know,
yeah.
It's a different...
Yeah, didn't last very long.
Yeah.
yeah, I was like, I hope I haven't bored you all, but I haven't had this happy feeling for a long time, and I'm enjoying it more than you all are, I'm sure. So I thank all of you. It's been so kind and enthused, and that's important. It's great. And this gentleman here, he's caught on. You did a great job with GNU, Roy.
Oh, Roy.
Yeah, I thought he was going to be here tonight.
Yeah, we were expecting Roy. I don't.
Okay. All right. Well, it's up to you all to call it a night. Unless you want to stay. I have a private chauffeur there. I have to ask him if he can stay later. That's great.
Well, thank you all so much. You've been a great audience as always, and I've had
they are, I'll tell you.
A wonderful time this evening. It's been fascinating for me to to just sit next to this guy and share his life and his memories. It's been really great. Thank you so much for having me. And we may have burned the Northwest out of its great engineers. I don't know. We've got to move on to another genre, maybe, Mike. I don't know. Microphone manufacturers.
Perhaps
or something. It's not as interesting, though.
There's always something else.
There's always something.
Yeah. You were great. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Well, for those of you who wondered why I have this and I stumble, I had brain surgery 2 weeks ago. And
well, I could never qualify for that.
Far from 100%. I thought you were going to say I didn't know you had a brain.
If I only had a brain.
Oh, dear.
So they leave this thing in, Frank? They leave this shunt in?
Oh, yeah.